Hello, everybody, and welcome to the very 297th episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, a podcast about board games, and the people who love board games.
Wow, that escalated.
It was operatic.
It was tonally a surprise to me, Matthew Lees, and I'm joined by you, the new opera singer on the podcast,
Tom Brewster.
Tom Brewster.
We're not doing anything that's like operatically themed this episode. I don't think there's really a coherent theme between the games.
I think you just felt the need to make a noise.
And yeah.
I respect that.
I've just got to fill the air somehow. That's sort of by the end of the podcast's life cycle. When we're on episode 5,000, it'll just be a series of incoherent mumbles between the two of us.
Yeah, and every now and then you'll make out the word Jenga.
Yeah.
around muffled noises and sound of breaking glass.
That sounds like it could be sort of a late career pivot for us. It's like pivoting to this idea that Jenga is actually the very best game there is. It's like the sort of purest form of fun.
I think it's up there. I think we did a live show at PAX Unplugged last year, I think, about the board game.
Oh, yes.
Battle. I think it was Board Game Bloodbath.
Board Game Bloodbath.
Which was trying to find out which was the best board game using the kind of like matchup system of fights. And I think, I can't remember, but I think Jenga did very well.
I think Jenga did very well, or it won, and it might have been up against Beyblades.
Yes, Beyblade was definitely a huge competitor. This is one of those times where it's a shame that there wasn't a video on demand of that room, because I think that room didn't have cameras. because of that, I'm not sure I remember what happened in the show. And maybe I never will.
Someone, a lovely fan of the show, drew us a nice picture.
They did.
Of me as a Beyblade.
Yep.
And I think you as a Jenga block.
Yep.
If I remember correctly.
Yep.
So, you know, let that stand as evidence.
That's all the evidence we need, Your Honor. We got them.
On this episode of the podcast, we're going to talk about four games. We're going to do a double bill of Bitewing Games' latest mythological bust-up with Moitura and Azure. Then, Matt, I'm going to tell you about canning fish in conservas.
Oh, I love fish.
And you're going to tell me about Daydream.
I'm going to tell you a little bit about Daydream.
Not again, not another Daydream.
You've got me singing now. I wish you hadn't done that.
Daydream, a podcast and a board game.
That was beautiful.
Thanks. First up on this podcast, we're going to talk about Moitura. This is a 2026 game designed by Trevor Benjamin and David Thompson, with art by A. Giroux and Harry Conway, published by Bitewing Games.
Mm.
And this is a game that on the table, you'll look at it and you'll be like, oh, this is a bish bash bosh area control fighty game where I'm going to try and cave in the skull of my opponent.
But no, you've been tricked.
Oh!
There is no caving in of any skulls.
Well.
Brackets. Not any humans. No. Only little barbarian, like, goblin
mythological
things.
Creatures, I think.
What were they called again?
Fomorians.
The Fomorians. I said the name Fomorians so much whilst playing it, I can't believe I've immediately forgotten it.
Every time you flipped a card, you went, oh my god, Tom, it's Fomorians.
It's Fomorians.
Which is a staggering number of times. 10 times for you to then forget the name of the thing.
It was fascinating, this game. It kind of appeared to have a slightly like pandemic-y shape in a way, or especially we played Fate of the Fellowship not that long ago, and having this system where you have these little like Fomorian strongholds where at the end of each round the human players are going to do something, then the bad pudding happens. You flip a card and one of the three colors of Fomorian troops are going to expand across this board,
this
down
Irish
these roads.
Board. Yes.
So it's like kind of area control, war-y looking thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the crucial thing was it wasn't cooperative, but also it wasn't nasty.
Yeah.
We weren't allowed to fight each other.
Yeah. Essentially, it has what you are looking at in front of you is an area control looking board. Lots of different regions that are going to score you points for having majority control of each of them. And in any normal game, I play as one color of pieces, you play as another color of pieces, I charge mine into yours, whoever controls the most space wins.
Yeah.
The twist with this is that, yes, there is a bit of that. You're jostling for control of these spaces, but you can never directly affect your opponent. You could only directly affect this sort of NPC faction that is spreading across the board.
Yes.
Trying to funnel them in certain directions so that they're going to clash with your opponent and not you.
Yes.
Also, we lost this game.
Yes, we did. And I think that's kind of interesting because fundamentally, it took me a while to understand the shape of this game, longer than I thought it would. I thought I had it, and then a few turns later, I was like, huh.
Because you look at it, and everything about it seems eminently understandable.
Yes.
You've played a dozen games that look like this in the last week.
Yeah, like on the side of the board, you've got these four different cards that represent like the four different deities that you can pray to on your turn.
Yes.
And you know, every time you use one, it becomes very expensive. It goes to the top of the track, but then the ones at the top that are more expensive are better. You can place down more units on the board. But on your turn, basically, you use one of these powers and they allow you to put new units onto the board in a variety of slightly different ways.
Right.
The thing about it that's funky, though, is that when you are putting new units onto the board, you're not actually like moving an army around.
No.
You move five units into an area. Those five units now live there. You cannot, when you move again from that space, you just put new things on.
Yes.
You're never actually moving any units, which is very strange for a game that looks like it's lots of armies moving around.
Right, yeah, you're not moving from one space to another, you're just plonking a bunch of new, freshly spawned units down, and you can't ever reinforce a space that you already have. If you put one unit down, that space now has one unit in it for the rest of the game.
Yes.
Unless they get killed
Unless
and
there's
replaced.
No one there anymore, at which point, yes, it's free now.
Go wild.
And I think that's what kind of threw me, was realizing that, oh, so actually, like, me chucking down, like, five units into an area... Mm-hmm. If it's not on a road next to a bunch of Fomorian barbarians who are going to come and chip away at them, then they're just going to stay there for the rest of the game, and there's nothing that can be done to move them, which is cool, because like maybe it'll help you win the area control for that area and you'll get loads of points. But also feels weirdly wasteful, where you're like, I plonked down that massive army there, and that's it now. It can't be attacked, it can't defend, it can't move, it's just there.
That was especially true in some parts of the board where like there are these like little cubbies where they're not on any direct route and you can just like stash a bunch of soldiers there, but you want to make sure that you're doing it in one big lump because you're never going to be able to reinforce that.
Nope.
It's never going to get chipped away, you're never going to build it back up again. It's really bizarre.
Very strange. And also the fact that like, yeah, you get rewarded for like going and moving into the areas that have these Fomorians in. If you kill them in that way, you have to like, combat is super simple. It's just one for one.
Yeah.
Like, so if you move five chips into an area that had three things, you now have two chips in that area. All of the other chips are gone.
Yeah.
But because that process happens at the end of the round with this flipping of cards, we had a very strange thing in the game we played where all of the green cards came up very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just expanded across the map, wiped out a lot of my people, but then we knew that for the rest of the game they were not going to move,
right,
which was kind of strange because you go, all right, well, I can kind of ignore that then. It wasn't like a threat I had to like bulk up, because by putting stacks of these chips onto areas, you were basically going, okay, well, I want to have some control in this area, but you were trying to account for how many you might lose, because it was an imperfect deck of these cards being flipped. Like, we didn't see how many we put, like...
We didn't see two of the cards.
Okay. So, like, out of a total of, like, 12 cards.
Yeah, but we also saw, I think, all four of the green cards in, like, the first round. It was crazy.
It was brutal.
And I will say, one of the strengths of this game is that we had what could be considered an extremely wonky game of Moitura in the fact that all of this stuff came out right at the start, and yet it was still very enjoyable to play in that sandbox.
Well, that's it. And I think it does have that, like, that kind of pandemic bones in a way. It's not, like, as complicated. And actually, I think that underneath the skin of it, it's kind of secretly like almost an abstract game.
It's very abstract.
Of being like, oh, okay. But the fact that you do have that setup being slightly unusual means you might have a game which is just very odd.
Mm-hmm.
Or you might have a game where you get beaten.
And I like that.
I like that a lot. And honestly, like, I felt I was getting beaten by the barbarians because they countered for the area control. And in a lot of areas, they just beat us. I was kind of fine with that because I felt like I was playing like a dick. I don't know about you, but I was definitely looking at things and going, huh, well, Tom's on that road with a couple of people and some barbarians are going to come and they're going to eat those people. And then soon as they do, I can move into that area. So in a way, even though we weren't like fighting, I wasn't allowed to attack you directly. It didn't mean I wasn't just sitting next to you waiting for you to die so I could go and sit in your house.
Yeah, it's
which
so...
is somehow worse.
It's very passive aggressive, right? Like you just have to wait for the enemy to do. And when a card gets flipped and it's not the right set of enemies that you wanted to move, it's hard to hide your disappointment that your opponent didn't just get a little bit gobbled.
And I mean, it very interesting, the shape of it, in terms of going, okay, well, you know, early game you were like, well, we've got this, I'm in control of this area, they're in control of this area. But when it becomes a bit mixed, it's like, well, I realized at the end of the game I was in real trouble when I had like, okay, we've got about an even amount of units in this area, but then I realized that like the way that the red Fomorians were spreading on the board, it meant that like, oh, but your area isn't at risk of being attacked by anything at all, whereas mine is going to be constantly getting chipped
away. You're
on
the front line.
And I was like, oh, I don't think I can, like, just realizing that it's like area control where like that's going to get diminished, you're going to lose control of that, and there's nothing you can do about it, like at all, really, like, because a lot of areas are just out of your reach. The map is interesting in the fact that you do have these powers that let you, like, one of them lets you hop over a space.
Yeah.
And, like, so you can't get walled in.
Or travel by sea.
Yeah, you're going up to five spaces away, providing it's connected by the same large wet body. and then, like, these things give you the flexibility to, like, move around the map in a way that's, like, surprising. Mm-hmm. But they also, later in the game, you're still limited if you haven't planned ahead. I like that a lot. It's definitely one, being a head-to-head game, that I think would benefit from repeat plays.
Yes.
Because we both got a little thrown. Mm-hmm. I think that the issue I had was the map was a little bit American-style gerrymandered.
Yes.
It's a very pretty looking game, mm-hmm. but I felt like some of the areas, like the coloring, was kind of similar.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than it being like a real hodgepodge, it was like yellow is next to the light yellow area, which is next to the... There's sort of a transition of color throughout the areas. And because some of these areas are like split up by a bit of water, or
that's a really weird one.
One of the areas is like a big L, a proper like gerrymandered style, like you state.
I didn't realize it curved round like that. Like I had a load of sort of units on the base of the L, and you had loads on the stem, and just they didn't connect.
And both of us thought we were in control of the area, and then we realized it wasn't
only
two areas.
Was
it was
right.
Like, oh, hang on a minute, like, and even it caught you out at the end where you're like, oh, I win this one. I'm like, no, you don't. There's a Fomorian down there.
There's
like,
guy.
That's part of this state. That was kind of silly. And also I think it was unfortunate that you're using these like circular tokens to put on the board, mm-hmm. and then the spots that tell you the points value of each area are printed on the areas in circles that are smaller, so it's very easy to cover them up. And actually I might have instinctively been covering them up because I know that my brain will just put circles
on circles. So true. There's many board games want you to do exactly that,
right? So I'm programmed to do that. So it meant that every time we wanted to remind ourselves of what the actual value of these areas controlled are, we played almost like a cup game of like having to lift up all these different circles to try and remember where it was.
How many points are hiding under here
again? Just would have been so easily fixed by like a slightly large like insinuation of a square,
right,
so that you couldn't ever completely cover up the container for the score or whatever.
And I also feel like they probably could have put it somewhere else on the board. Like the map of Ireland that this game is played on is not as big as the board itself. Maybe they could have had them in the little sea spaces around it.
There definitely would have been a solution. It's not like a game breaker, but those two things I felt like slightly got in the way of things in a way that was just a bit of a shame, and otherwise a really lovely game and a lovely production.
Yeah, I thought this was very sharp. I was surprised by how much I liked it because it is so weird to start with, and it is, as you say, very abstract, but in a theme with these new Bytewing mythological games. We also quite liked Azure, which is even more abstract.
It is even more abstract, but at least it doesn't pretend it's not.
It's true. This one is the most abstract looking abstract game I've seen in a hot minute. The back of the box has some crazy stuff going on. It says grow in bonds and reduce your chi cost as you align your stones. Like, what does that mean?
You get the word chi and stones in a game, you know you're in for an abstract time. Like,
collect the boons from your chosen space.
The components in this as well, it has the classic, the abstract minstrels.
It does have the little abstract lozenges.
The little black and white sweeties that are
very nice.
They're beautiful, right? But you see those, you know you're playing an... I guess that's from the game Go.
Right.
It's the more classically thing. But generally speaking, I don't think I've ever played a game that has those lozenges that isn't
that
abstract.
Isn't somehow abstract? No, for sure. Well, maybe no thanks.
I'm thinking, yeah,
well,
no
I guess
thanks.
That is kind of abstract.
I'm thinking, actually, there was the Reinach Nitzia bidding one with the animals, the fairy
bidding
thing.
One with the animals.
I really liked it.
Equinox,
that's it.
Wow.
That had those.
Deep pull. This is a game designed by Trevor Benjamin and Brett J. Gilbert, with art by Quanchai Moria, again, published by Bytewing Games. And this is a kind of a very hard one to explain, I think, in the audio podcast format.
We'll give it a go.
You've got a grid in front of you, a grid of different spaces. And on those spaces, you are going to place these little abstract minstrels, as you put them. But in order to place those stones on those spaces, you need cards matching the color of the space. This grid is divided into sort of four quadrants. There's a red one, a white one, a blue one, and a brown one, I think. And if you want to place in the little brown quadrant, you will need to spend a number of brown cards equal to the number of things that are on the space you want to place on. So if there is a little picture of a card and a little picture of a circle on a space, you need to spend two brown cards to place one of your lozenges on that space. However, as the game progresses, you get discounts on placing these things if you have other stones in the same row or column as where you're placing.
Yeah.
So you could have a hand that has no brown cards in it whatsoever, but if you've got a bunch of different stones in the row and column, even if they're in the red and white zone, you can still plonk a little piece down there.
So you start to build up like what feels a bit like an economy almost.
Yes.
Of you going, well, I've got two of these blue cards. Mm-hmm. So do I want to start placing some things down in the blue area?
Mm-hmm.
Then which might eventually afford me something in the red area, because you know the lines are all continuing across. It means you can sort of like hoard cards mm-hmm. of a certain type, and as you see, like on the areas that have the cards printed on them, you get that card as a reward for controlling it,
which so, might not necessarily be the same color of card as you just placed.
I don't think they ever are. Maybe they, or they often aren't. So it will be a case of going, well, I've got three of these blue cards. Do I want now to go and jump and start taking some easy to take territories in the blue area, or do I want to go somewhere else mm-hmm. where I can get another blue card and get up a big hand so I can take a juicy, expensive space? Because not all spaces are as good as each other. Not only do some of the spaces get you just loads more points,
mm-hmm.
but there are these sort of mountain areas on the board. Well, these figures that appear when
you
take
what they're called?
Certain spaces. I know what they're called, Tom. You got big turtle, you got a dragon, there was maybe a bear.
I think they're called auspicious beasts.
That's pretty much what I said.
Each of them has their own like little unique power. So if you're kind of jostling for control of one of them, you're hoping to get that and then fold it into your strategy. Some are just worth points.
Yeah.
Some make it easier to make those connecting lines. I can't remember exactly. It's not important.
Yeah, like some of them just give you little buffs. Some of them give you points, and the points go back and forth when you take control. You take control of these things, again, by having majority control in these horizontal and vertical lines.
Yeah.
So you have a thing and you go, okay, well, we look at all the lines going out either side of these things, and you go, who has the most pieces on those places?
Except for one of them, which is like, you need to control those like snaky spaces.
Yeah, the snaky spots.
There's a special snaky
where, again,
guy.
You take control of that by just being like around.
Kind of everywhere.
And then I think there's another one where you control it by being near to it. Doesn't really matter.
Doesn't matter for your purposes.
The crucial thing.
Podcast listener.
Exactly. As a listener, doesn't matter. What matters is that not only are you trying to place these things onto the grid in a way that's going to help you build up like an economy, so if you can get three of your things in a row, then that fourth thing in that line,
that's cheap as
doesn't
chips.
Matter how expensive it is, you get a big old discount now.
Have it.
But you're also trying to put them in a way that is savvy, because you can't replace these things. You can't remove a thing once it's down. So you want to kind of secure your control of the big auspicious beasts to get those points at the end of the game.
Get in the way of your opponent.
And also, they're kind of funky in the fact that these beasts kind of block lines of sight.
Yes.
So it means that like when you are trying to get discounts, you know, you're looking at what things are not blocked by a big auspicious beast.
By a big bear.
And I think that was one of the bonuses, was like the mountain bonus. Was that you got to put your little token on top
and
it counted
right through it
as something that could see across in all these directions, which might just help pip you to the post on a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
So again, an abstract on paper, but I think the physicality of these creatures and the way that you're trying to like control them, but also the way they block line of sight.
Yeah.
The use of the phrase like line of sight. And then the fact that you have hands of cards, mm-hmm. even though the cards are all just colors,
they're
there's no numbers
color,
it's like a red card, a blue card, kind of throws me in that kind of game. I keep drawing and flipping the cards over expecting it to be the back of a card because they're all the same.
Yeah, I get you.
But no,
it doesn't matter.
That, and then also the way that the game felt like it had an economy
mm-hmm.
in terms of like the shape of it, really created something that I liked a lot more than I usually like abstract games.
I'm not sure what it is about these two games specifically, that they are very abstract experiences that we normally struggle with a bit.
Yeah.
We tend to give a little bit of short shrift, maybe. I think it's something about the amount of hidden information that's in them that makes it feel a little wobblier.
I think,
or hidden trackable, maybe.
I think both of them have like area control energy, but with a little bit of spice to it.
Yeah.
In the way that like the little bit of spice in the first one is the idea of like, yeah, but you can't take someone else's territory. So you just have to try and set up a scenario where they get battered by someone else and then you can take their territory, which is just lovely. But I think in this, I like the way that at the start of the game, it had that kind of like boom economy
mm-hmm.
where like you could just go and take these lots of easy spaces where you could just go and take a red card, take mm-hmm. a blue card. And it allowed you to like fill out your hand with like loads of one color and have these big plays where you go like, bang, now I'm going to take this slot for four.
Yeah.
In a position where you go, oh, damn, you've taken control of this and this. And that gets you bonuses and all these things. But then those spaces where you get to pick up extra cards are all the cheap, easy ones.
Mm-hmm.
And quite quickly, once we've taken almost all of them, we started to realize like, oh, like if I want to get like another like red card. Like there's only like one more space on the board to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way that was like, yeesh, that's like, you know, you started to realize that what felt like an endless bounty became like a really limited control resource.
And I like how it does narrow to a point quite quickly, this game. Like our games that were very snappy is the kind of game that we immediately went, should we just play another one straight afterwards? Because it has a satisfying shape to it that once you've seen, you immediately want to sort of dive in again and give it another go.
But it's funny. I think that like the combination of these auspicious beasts being like specific like area control but also blocking sight combined with the fact that the easy spaces you would take early on would be basically one-off resource manage like resource creation did give it a little bit of like that kind of like generating resources, building things. It gave it like the abstraction of like a kind of war game in a way that actually like gave the game a shape that was really, really pleasant.
These are both really neat little games.
They are.
And I think that they're different as well in a way that I think the first two games in the mythological series that Bitewing were doing, it was Iliad and Ikor. Mm. And they felt like they were different, but maybe not to the extent that these two are different. But yet they have enough in common that will very much appeal to a certain kind of games player. I don't know.
I think so. Really, I think elegant. It's funny because they're both relatively small boxes as well. Yeah. I kind of feel like Azure is like the smaller box. Mm-hmm. But in a way, you know, that's the game that I think has the biggest small box energy. Again, sure. we played it and then
biggest
immediately...
small box energy.
But then it's funny. I think I feel like the other has a small box game, and it's not the kind of game you play and think, let's play again straight away.
Yeah.
It's more of a, like a session.
Which is weird because they probably took us around the same amount of time.
Right, exactly. Exactly, which is interesting. I think out of the two, I think I prefer Azure, really, I think. Just because I feel like it is more inherently like get out and playable. But
even
I like them
the,
both.
Even though the cover for Azure is like a hallucinatory nightmare. Mm. You seen this thing?
Yeah, it's got animals on it. As far as I remember, animals in a mountain?
Look at that. What's going on there?
I'm wrong.
This is great.
It's got animals. Guess what Matt is about to look at? The game. I mean, when you started explaining the game, I started chuckling in my brain because I was like, whenever we're trying to explain an abstract game on the podcast, I feel like we're not that far off of trying to like give a child a geometry lesson via audio only and being like, so a square, right? Well, it's like,
here's how a square works. It's got four
lines, four lines, the perpendicular, but like, and what does perpendicular mean? Like trying a circle. It's like one line, but whole.
Matt, I would like to very briefly talk to you about Conservus.
Oh, go on then.
This is a game about canning fish. Mm. It's more exciting than I've made it sound.
That's very on point.
There's
a big trend in the world of short form online video right now about people enjoying canned fish.
There is. Are they enjoying it or are they kind of hating it?
I mean, I don't know.
It's a stinky fish.
I find the whole thing very bemusing, frankly, because it seems to be people just going, did you know you could buy fish in a can? And then eating fish in a can and either going, I don't like this, or going, this is nice,
pretty
actually.
Good.
And I'm like, have we just run out of things to talk about now? Like, what's happening?
We're going to go back to spam. That's going to be really exciting.
Like, did you know we put meat in cans? Yes, I did. What's the next question?
I want to see like a wave of TikTok influencers getting to grips with Frey Bentos. That's what I want to see. I want to see that. That's going to be great. This is a game designed by Scott Alms with art by Jorge Tabanera Redono. Published by Salt and Pepper Games, who we talked about on the last podcast, maybe?
Yes.
With Operation Barclay.
Yes.
And I thought I'll give this little game a go because it is a solo-only game.
Right.
About conserving fish. And it's a solo bag builder.
A solo bag builder.
I said conserving fish. It's about putting some of them into a can.
Well, it's conserving fish. It is conserving fish. It's conserving fish as a food product, not as a creature.
It is doing both. You do got to do both. You got to do conservation goals and canning goals.
Look, I conserved it. Well, what you've done actually is you've killed it and put it in a can. Yeah, so I can have it later.
So I can have it forever if I want. So the way this game works is very straightforward. In front of you, you will have a little card that represents the open ocean. And a little card that represents your little fishing boat. And then you have a bag. And inside that bag, you have all kinds of little tokens. You start with a certain ratio of fish to just open water tokens.
Okay.
And each round, you're going to reach into that bag and you're going to pull five tokens out of it. And you're going to choose if you want to put those tokens on your boat or if you want to put them back into the ocean.
Right.
If you put them on your boat will have a capacity. So for example, my boat could have three capacity. So three of those tokens will go on the boat. The other two go in the ocean below it.
Okay.
If you choose to put them in the ocean, they all just get dumped into the ocean.
Okay.
Once you've done that stuff, you then go back to the harbor and you can either can those fish that you've got on your boat, putting them into little scoring spaces on this little scoring rubric that'll get you money, or you can use them to buy upgrades, which will give you various different powers.
Are you sometimes taking back big bags of seawater then? If you're pulling things out of a bag, I mean, just like buckets and buckets of seawater.
Which will do nothing.
I was going to say.
You'll release that back into the ocean for free.
Ah.
The thing is that anything that you spend gets removed from the game completely. Well, it goes back into the supply, right?
The fish are dead.
Yes, the fish are dead. You turn them into an upgrade.
It's important.
Or money.
That people understand that when you take a fish back to port and sell it to someone for upgrades or money, that fish probably isn't going back to the sea.
It's probably not going to go back in the sea no more.
Yes, you've got Harpoon Plus One. But just at what cost?
And the goal of the game, basically, is to earn a certain amount of money by the end of it. So you want to be selling these fish. You want to bring them back to land. You want to turn them into canned tuna, whatever. However, if you do that from turn one till the end of the game, you're going to run out of fish in the bag almost immediately.
Yeah.
And so that's where the open ocean spaces and the space under your boat come in.
Plenty more. Oh, no, there aren't. No. Plenty more fish in the bag.
No more fish in the bag. They all got eaten or turned into a smoking. If you leave fish in the open ocean spaces, then they have the chance to reproduce, giving you more in the bag.
Oh my gosh, we're doing Roads and Boats donkey style.
The miracle of life.
You pull the fish out, you leave them alone in a space. As long as there's nothing they can see, then more fish will happen.
You get X plus one fish, which I think is kind of funny. Like if there's two fish, they will have one fish baby. If there's four fish,
still only one baby.
No. They always will give you one less than the amount of fish that you have.
Oh, so it's X fish, minus one.
X minus one.
Okay, because I was going to say, I'm like, that's not how anything works.
And so you have to sort of do this little balancing act of making sure that you are taking fish out to get upgrades, to buy more boats so you can fish more, but also making sure that you're keeping the population of fish in the sea healthy. Because at the end of the game, yes, you are looking to get a certain amount of money, but at the end you empty out the bag, and you need to make sure you have a certain threshold of each kind of fish at the end. And what was really interesting in my plays of this is that the first time I just didn't really, like, I overfished the ocean immediately. It was a nightmare.
Yeah, why wouldn't you?
Like, I just dragged out all the fish, I turned them into tuna, and then I was like, I've got enough money, but there's literally nothing left in the ocean anymore. The second time I played it, I ran out of one specific kind of fish. And there's this really interesting thing that happens where, like, I knew that there were two blue fish in the bottom of my bag somewhere, but I didn't have enough pulls of the bag to actually get them.
To find them
and then have them reproduce. Which was then later on, I found there were these boats that only had one storage space on them. And I was like, well, what's the point in that? I only get to put one fish on my boat. Well, I was using those just so I got another pull of the bag so that I could make sure that on that boat, I put one bit of water and then dropped all the fish in the sea below it. You almost have these like scout boats that you can like send out to make sure that the ocean stays healthy.
So you were basically like diluting the ocean.
Yeah.
No, you weren't diluting it. It's the opposite.
I was enriching the ocean.
Yeah, you were like pulling out buckets of seawater so it was easier to find the fish.
Yeah, to find the fish that I needed.
Stop the podcast. I've got to call up Captain Birdseye. I've got the best idea. It's going to revolutionize his business.
I found this game really pleasant. I was really surprised by how much I liked it. It's been sat on my shelf for ages. I don't really have that much time to play solo games. Right now, I've got terrible RSI, so I thought, why not? Let's give it a go. And I had a lovely time. There's a little book that has the different months of the year. And each
I was
going to
say, is it like
criteria.
A little campaign?
Yeah, essentially, like a very loose campaign. It says you can sort of start anywhere you want within it if you want.
Got it.
But each one, like, you'll have more fish in the bag. This one only had two kinds of fish. But
and at any point, you might have to turn to the back page of the manual. It's just a picture of a skull. It says, look at what you've done. Look at what you've
How
done.
How many fish have you killed?
You turned all the fish monster. Into fingers. What have you done?
On that note, I really like the fact that the card backs are cans. It's very sweet. They're like the little decks. Each deck of cards just has a little like pull tab on it and like a little rim that makes it like a little can. It's
oh, that
cute.
Is fun. Like
all
a little,
the production is really nice.
Like a little. So it's subtly egging you on.
It's subtly being like,
go on.
Get these little briny boys
Don't kill too
there.
Many of them. But make sure you put some of them in a can for Uncle Sardines.
It's a good game.
I don't like Uncle Sardines. I think he's a creep.
Yeah, let's remove Uncle Sardines from the podcast.
Yeah, get rid.
Finally, on this podcast, Matt, you wanted to talk about Daydream.
Yes.
Roll'n'Write game.
Yes. I played this Roll'n'Write game when I was visiting the Gathering of Friends in North America.
Wow.
It's a place that's next to Niagara Falls, but on the US side, which is
the worst side?
Incredibly bleak. Actually, it was less bleak now than it was prior. So well done to the area of Niagara Falls. Seems like you're actually...
Congratulations.
You're trying to turn it around. Fair play. I played this and had a really satisfying, good time.
This is a game designed by Anthony Perrone and Benoit Turpin with art by Mem Candia and published by Disto Studio. And it looks really cute, Matt.
It is.
It's very sort of pastel colored.
Yes, it's very
lo-fi.
It's very like lo-fi beats to chill out to vibes.
Yeah.
Of having somebody on a sofa chilling out. It's all pinks and blues and nice, lovely hues. And it's a game of doing things with results. So you roll some dice and then you look at the results.
It's a game of manipulating data.
And you do something with the dice.
Wow.
But what you do with the dice... it's going to vary quite considerably.
No way.
Because this is a weird game.
Okay.
It's a very lovely little box.
It looks like a straightforward Roll'n'Write. Are you telling me it's less straightforward than I'm thinking?
Yes and no.
Oh.
Is the answer to that little pickle.
Wow, this is scintillating.
So effectively, this board has like four different sides to it. It's like a slender board that folds.
Oh.
So it has like a fourfold, like a menu from a takeaway.
Like a pamphlet.
Or like a pamphlet, but like made of solid cardboard. Like... And what's funny about this is it means that like you choose the difficulty and I guess the length of the game and the intensity of the game.
Oh, by how many folds?
By how much of the board you're playing with, right? So you'd be like, maybe we're just going to play with one little thin bit. Maybe we're going to fold it out for two.
Much like a takeaway.
Yep.
Yep. You choose the difficulty of your takeaway with how many parts of the menu you order from.
How many pages you order from.
Yeah, it's crazy you have to order the entire page of the menu every time you get stuff.
But it means that like we played like the A side originally, right? And it was like, okay, so it meant that like you were playing the A side and then at the bottom it would say like, here's the end game scoring, right? Mm-hmm. But then you could fold it out and then it'd be like AD.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be like, oh, and now we're playing with the A side and the D side, which means we're scoring this and this. And there'd be like elements that maybe crossed over because these fold to form like different pictures as well.
Right, okay.
So the way you fold the board creates like more of this view of a room and the sky and stuff in the background. More of this lovely picture.
That's very cute.
But it kind of blew our minds in the fact that it was like, oh, but there's also a scoring for DA as well as AD. How does that work? And we realized, oh yeah, the way it folds is you can fold it around backwards so that the D side is now on the other side of A. So it's left to right, right to left, in a way that felt like we'd done a magic trick. We're like, but that's not possible. How can you fold it so that this side is on the other side? And it's like, watch this. Hold my chill beer.
Wow.
As we went, wow. So immediately, like, that's quite a lot of fun that you have something which is like quite a malleable game where like you can play it in a bunch of different ways and it has different scoring conditions and different playing styles. So immediately you have things in the background. Like at one point we're like, well, what do these do? These things. And it's like, oh, well, they're not on this board. They're a part of the board when you're playing with C as well. So ignore that. But the way it worked is that you'd have the components on the current like play area of the board that you'd all choose that would be things that you would be playing with and scoring. So the one we played with involved like having these items on a shelf.
Yeah.
So you'd roll the dice and then you would like, put these numbers into an area which would allow you then to, when you successfully like did a thing in this little grid, which would had a very funny and satisfying puzzle where you were trying to put numbers into what looked like a kind of a crossword style grid.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like a straightforward just like X by X grid.
No.
It's like a little snaky.
It's very snaky. And then it's also like has placement rules where you have to place adjacently, which means like, okay, if I want to... So you start off with a couple of starting spots and then you have to place numbers that are on the dice adjacent to numbers that you already have. With the crucial thing that you're going to get bonus points if you manage to fill out a row with no matching numbers. All numbers are different. But you get even more points if you can get them to be ascending or descending.
Right.
So you can do 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah, yeah.
That's going to be great. But it turns out this was really hard because it's crosswordy. It means you then put a 3 into a box and then you're like, oh, hang on a minute. Now that 3 has to be either ascending or descending from that point on that line. So you kind of had lines where you had to be like, I'm going to try and do this one as one continuous number string. This one is like, you know,
This is the scrap zone.
Exactly.
This is where I throw the leftovers.
You quite quickly be like, this is the scrap zone. And because you had to build out from like previously placed squares,
yes.
I quickly had an amazing start to the game and then realized that I'd gone off down all these threads and then had an area of the board that was just like one pipeline. Oh, and I was like, oh no. For the next five turns, like, I don't have any choice where I place these. I just have to place
down
them
this horrible corridor.
On this corridor, right, yeah. Right. But it's very satisfying because basically you're playing this horrible little game of placing the numbers mm-hmm. in areas, and then the rewards you get for doing it are being able to draw these lines up on the... Like, basically you're drawing outlines around these different objects on the shelves.
Little connect the dots.
The connect the dots thing here was very satisfying in the fact that, like, if you manage to finish a line, like, really well mm-hmm. and doing it like by the rules, then well done. When you were doing the dot to dot, you go on the big stars of the constellation, not the little one, which means you go bang bang and you basically fill in four lines by two.
I see.
But what was horrible and lovely, and you'll notice I keep saying horrible, that's partly a compliment but it's relevant, is that occasionally you'd be like, oh, well, I didn't get the best way of filling that in, so I only get the little lines, and I get to do three of them. Mm-hmm. And then you go bang, bang, bang. And then you're like, eh, I've only half filled in that line, which means even next time you get a full big line.
Right.
No, you don't. You just fill in a half. And that wastage, that feeling of like, I lost half a line there.
That's not data manipulation. That's not what we like.
That eats away at you. That's unpleasant. You've also got, as you'd expect, the kind of lovely combolicious stuff of being able to, like, the shapes that you're filling in at the top, you have to do it left for right and continue, but like how many lines there are on the objects changes vastly as it goes along. Mm-hmm. So it's like you can get on a bit of a run and you can just start powering through lots of small objects, which is very satisfying, gives the game an interesting kind of like moment where you look around and go, how are you that far ahead? And then suddenly they are as well, and you're like, yeah, right, you have little explosions. But the simplicity that was nice, and the fact that at the end of the game it was just like there wasn't really much scoring. A lot of it was just a case of looking at like, well, how far ahead did you
I
get?
Like that,
like, it was quite simple to be okay, the point scoring did not take much time.
Yeah, if you can just tell visually from someone's board what they've scored, I so much prefer that to like meticulously counting out exactly how many points you've got.
Exactly.
Tiny source.
There was some lovely little rubs in how this worked. Like there was in the version we played, and I don't know what all the rules are for all the different versions, but the fold out, one of the ones we played that stuck with me was these, there were four squares on your little like crosswordy number grid. Mm. The numbers you put into there would go on these like picture frames in the background.
Right.
And it meant that like, the moon ones I think were like negative and the sun ones were positive. You'd have to try and get like really high numbers in the suns and then really low numbers mm-hmm. or even negative I think was possible because you could manipulate the numbers using bonuses and stuff in the other ones to try and like get a net great score. But doing that kind of came at the cost of trying to build efficient chains of numbers, and I like the way that you could save up a lot of your like bonus, you know, the things you unlock in Roll of Rights where it's like, well, now you can cross this off or do some extra
freebie.
You can save up all the freebie bonuses to then like do some really cool plays of like making, like turning a one into a zero and stuff like that. In a way that was like, this is very satisfying.
It seems really cute.
I'm doing some cool stuff. Honestly, I liked it a lot. And I think the only thing that really made me laugh about it is the fact that, yeah, it was an absolute head messer crunch fest. And I found it fascinating playing it because I was like, it reminded me of playing Stardew Valley.
Right.
And the fact that I was like, this is ostensibly being framed as like this chill, nice time vibes.
Right. But I'm not going to make it that
way. I cannot enjoy it like that. I am in weird hell crunch mode trying to efficiently do this puzzle. Mm. And it kind of made me wonder. I'm like, on the one hand, I'm like, is this chill aesthetic a cynical thing? And we get addicted to these things. Or do I just have the kind of ADHD brain that means that I will never be able to relax? And this is a horrible trap that makes me feel like, hey, let's all have a chill, cozy time. Because I can't think of a cozy game I've played which has actually allowed me to feel chill and cozy.
Comment below if you think Matt will ever be able to relax.
Right? I don't know. Is it me? Am I the problem? Either way, I really like this game.
Thank you very much, everybody, for listening to this week's episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast. We talked about Moitura, we talked about Azure, we talked about Conservus, and we talked about Daydream. If you want more from Shut Up and Sit Down, then you should check out our monthly-ish newsletter where we talk about what we've been up to in the world of video games.
Mm.
How did Tom get his horrible RSI? I'll never tell.
You told last month's newsletter. You made it very clear. Now it's like, oh yeah, like Star Wipe to RSI. Like, I'm obsessed with this game.
You can find out all about that in the newsletter and maybe even get some little bonus videos as well, some little extra bits for our top 100 series.
You know, we're already coming around to the time when next newsletter should probably be made, but it's there's some fun stuff in the last one. I think that one of the last ones we put out had four different things in it.
Four whole things.
Yeah.
For you to clap your eyes on and support Shut Up and Sit Down in the process.
100%.
Have a great week, everybody. We shall see you next time.
Goodbye.